Usually when we sit down to talk about artificial intelligence, the narrative is almost always about more. More speed, more accuracy, more optimization.
Yeah, it's always the pursuit of objective perfection, like building this oracle that just doesn't make mistakes.
Exactly. You build a chess engine and you want it to never lose. You build a diagnostic tool, you want to catch absolutely every single cancer cell. But looking through the research stack for today's deep dive into the source material, I was honestly struck by how messy this topic is.
It's incredibly messy.
Because we aren't talking about perfection today. We're looking at a technology that is explicitly designed not to be perfect, but to be specific. A technology designed to capture not just human genius, but human failure.
And that is a fundamental shift in the architecture. We're moving from optimization, finding the best answer, to replication, mimicking a specific person. And the literature calls this mimetic AI. And that shift, it drags us into some incredibly uncomfortable ethical territory.
It really does. And our mission today is to use a very specific case study to unpack this. It's a dilemma that honestly feels like it belongs in a darker sci-fi show, but the technology to build it basically exists right now on your phone.
Yeah, the hardware and software are already here.
So it's a collision between our technical capability to cure loneliness and our philosophical commitment to the truth.
Specifically, it forces us to choose between two values we usually think go hand in hand, right? Dignity and psychological health. But you're right, before we get to the mother dilemma, which is the core thought experiment from the sources, we need to nail down the mechanism, because mimetic sounds like a buzzword.
It does.
What does it actually mean in the context of large language models?
So the sources start with a really accessible comparison to ground this, and it's chess. If I play a standard chess engine right now, what am I actually playing against?
You're playing against a math equation, basically. A standard chess engine doesn't have personality. It doesn't care if it's playing a grandmaster or a toddler. It looks at the board, it calculates the probability tree for millions of moves, and plays the objectively optimal move to crush you.
It's pure truth-seeking.
It wants the best move, period.
Okay, but the sources highlight a completely different kind of engine, one trained specifically on the games of, say, Garry Kasparov.
And this is where the nuance is really important for mimetic AI. If you train a model only on Kasparov's games, you aren't optimizing for victory anymore. You're optimizing for prediction.
The AI is essentially asking, what would Garry do?
Precisely.
Which means it copies his aggressive brilliance, sure. But, and this is the key insight for me when I was reading this, it also has to copy his blind spots.
That is the critical distinction. If Kasparov had a tendency to overextend his knights in the mid-game, or if he got tilted after a specific opening, the mimetic AI must make that same mistake. If the AI plays a better move than Kasparov would have played in that exact moment, it has failed the mimetic test.
So to be a good mimetic AI, it actually has to be a bad chess player in the exact same way the human was.
We are treating error as a feature.
Which is wild.
It is, and that's easy to swallow when it's just a board game. Like, who cares if a bot blunders a knight? But apply that logic to a professional context. The sources mention this idea of a mimetic philosopher.
Yeah, I found this part fascinating. Imagine you train a model on every single paper written by a specific Kantian scholar.
So that model might be brilliant at explaining the concept of autonomy because the original professor was brilliant at it. But if the original professor had a terrible, flawed understanding of dignity, or if they had a massive blind spot regarding a certain counterargument, the AI must be terrible at explaining dignity.
It has to preserve the limitation.
It preserves the limitation. It's almost like we're creating a digital ghost. It's not a library of general knowledge. It's a preservation of a specific perspective, flaws and all.
And that is the hook. Because if we could do that for a chess grandmaster or a philosophy professor using public data, we can do it for anyone using private data.
Anyone at all.
We can do it for a family member.
Which brings us to the core of the deep dive today.
This brings us to the mother dilemma. This scenario comes up repeatedly in the ethics seminars discussed in the reading, and I want to walk through it slowly because the details really matter here.
They do.
It's not just a hypothetical, it's a very real portrait of modern aging.
It is a brutal scenario. It centers on a woman, let's just call her the mother, The profile is pretty standard for Western gerontology. She is elderly, she's a widow, and she is completely immobile.
And the source material really emphasizes the isolation here. It's not just that she lives alone, it's that her entire social fabric has basically dissolved.
Right.
Her husband is gone, her friends are either deceased or they've moved into high care facilities where they can't even manage to use a phone.
So she is in a state of what sociologists call social death before actual death. And the result is this compounded condition. She's lonely, which leads to deep depression.
Yeah.
The depression kills her motivation to move or eat, which leads to physical atrophy. It's a massive downward spiral.
Loneliness isn't just a sad feeling here. It's a biological toxin.
Exactly. It's lethal.
So, enter the sun. Now, it's really easy to paint the sun as the villain in these sorts of tech scenarios, but the sources frame him as desperate.
Right, he loves her.
He wants to help, but he lives in the real world.
He's not negligent, he's just constrained. He has a demanding job, maybe kids of his own financial limits.
Yeah.
He cannot physically move in with her, and he can't afford $30 an hour companion care 24 hours a day.
Right.
He is basically watching his mother wither away simply because he cannot be in two places at once.
But he has the technology.
Yeah.
He has access to a large language model and a sophisticated voice synthesis tool. And we're talking about stuff like advanced voice modes that already exist.
Oh, yeah, it's very accessible.
So he builds a mimetic AI.
An avatar of himself.
Exactly. He feeds it his text history, his emails, hours of his own voice data. He prompts it with his own personality traits, his humor, his patience level, even his specific verbal tics.
And then he puts this agent on a simplified phone or a smart speaker right next to her bed. And he tells her mom, I have a new setup at work where I can be on the line all the time. Whenever you feel lonely, just talk and I'll be there.
And the intervention isn't high-minded, right? The bot isn't simulating a debate about politics or the meaning of life.
No.
It's just, how was lunch? Did you see the blue jay outside? I love you, Mom.
And here is the variable that matters most for this whole discussion. It works.
It actually works.
The data from similar interventions, and keep in mind, the sources note this happens even using older non-mimetic bots like Wobot, shows that this kind of interaction is a massive physiological unlock.
The sources were pretty explicit about this. It's not just that she feels nice. She literally gets out of bed.
Correct. Because she feels observed and loved, her cortisol drops, her serotonin rises, she eats better because her son asked her to.
Right, she takes her meds because he reminded her.
The depression actually lifts. The lie acts as a literal medicine. She might live 5 years longer simply because of this software.
But, and here's the wall we run into, the efficacy of that cure depends entirely on the deception.
That's the catch. She has to believe it's him.
Right.
If she knows it's an algorithm, the placebo effect collapses. It just becomes a sad reminder of her loneliness. Like, my son is too busy, so here is his script.
So the son faces a binary choice. There is no middle ground here.
None.
Option A, you lie to your mother. You manipulate her perception of reality to ensure her health and happiness. Or option B, you tell the truth. You preserve her dignity. You treat her as an adult capable of handling reality, but you accept that she will likely relapse into depression and die sooner.
So put yourself in the seminar room where this is being debated. You're the regulator. What do you do?
Well, my gut reaction, and I think the reaction of most listeners right now, is just lie to her.
Yeah.
It seems cruel not to. Who cares about abstract truth if she's happy and healthy?
And that's the teleological argument. You're looking at the ends, the outcome.
Right. The ends justify the means. I mean, we tell kids Santa Claus exists because it creates magic and joy. Why is this different?
That's exactly where about two-thirds of people land in the initial surveys cited in the research. Two-thirds. They view it as benevolent paternalism. They say, I am the caregiver. I know what keeps her alive. I will curate her reality.
But then you have the other third, the holdouts in these seminars. What is their argument? Because to me, insisting on the truth here just feels, it feels cold. It feels academic in the worst way.
Well, they are the deontologists, the Kantians. Their argument is that by lying, you are treating the mother as a means to an end.
Okay.
You are treating her like a potted plant that just needs to be watered and given sunlight rather than a human being with a rational mind.
They'd say you're stripping her of her dignity.
Exactly. They argue that dignity is inextricably linked to reality. If you live in a simulation, you have no agency. You are basically a pet. And they would argue that a painful truth is always superior to a pleasant lie because it honors the person's humanity.
Okay, so we have the life camp versus the truth camp. And usually in these sorts of ethical debates, people just dig into their trenches and stay there.
Right.
But The source material mentions a twist in the survey data that completely blew my mind.
This is the most fascinating part of the research, honestly. So first you ask the students, should the son lie to the mother? Two-thirds say yes. It's a clear majority.
Save the mom.
But then you flip the question. You ask them, imagine you are the elderly parent. You are the one in that bed. Do you want your children to lie to you?
Yeah. What happens?
The statistics flip completely. Suddenly, two-thirds say, hell no.
Wait, really? It flips that much?
Yes. They say, don't you dare manipulate me. I have a right to know who I'm talking to. I don't want to be patronized.
That is a staggering contradiction.
That is.
We are perfectly willing to deceive someone else for their own good.
Yeah.
But we absolutely refuse to surrender our own reality for our own good.
It reveals a profound hypocrisy in how we value autonomy. We prioritize our own agency, our right to reality, above our potential happiness. We'd rather be miserable and real than happy and fooled.
Right.
But when we look at someone else, especially someone vulnerable like an elderly parent, we prioritize their happiness above their agency. We infantilize them.
We turn them into objects of care rather than subjects of life.
Exactly. And this leads us to what the paper calls the paradox of autonomy. Usually in political philosophy, we think of freedom and dignity as friends. They walk hand in hand.
Right. To be free is to be dignified and vice versa.
But mimetic AI turns them into enemies. Think about the definitions here in this context. If the son lies, he strips her of dignity. She's being fooled. She's the butt of the joke, effectively.
Yeah.
But he grants her functional autonomy. By curing her depression, he gives her the biological capacity to move, to act, to live independently.
So the lie makes her physically free, but philosophically a slave to a deception.
Conversely, if he tells the truth, he grants her dignity. He respects her mind. But the resulting depression strips her of functional autonomy. She becomes bedridden. She becomes a prisoner of her own biology.
That is a brutal trap.
It really is.
You can give her the right to truth or the ability to move, but you cannot give her both.
And the worst part is the irreversibility of it all. This isn't a decision you can make by committee with the patient. You cannot ask the mother, hey, mom, would you like me to use an AI avatar to trick you into feeling loved?
Right, because the question itself destroys the trick. It's like asking someone if they want a placebo. Once you say the word placebo, it immediately stops working.
Exactly. She cannot take responsibility for this choice. The son must play God. He has to decide whether her subjective experience of happiness is worth more than her objective connection to reality.
And frankly, that is a terrifying power to hand over to an algorithm or a family member.
Absolutely.
But I want to pivot slightly because the sources bring up a secondary argument that reinforces this dignity side. It argues that the damage isn't just to the mother, it's to the concept of connection itself.
Yes. This is the counterfeit economy argument. It comes from scholars like Frank Pasquale. The analogy here is money.
Okay, walk me through that.
Imagine you have a printing press in your basement that makes perfect, undetectable $100 bills. You print $1 million for the first week. How do you feel?
I feel incredible. I'm rich. I'm buying everything. Subjectively, my experience is peak happiness.
Right. But objectively, what happens to the economy if everyone does this?
Inflation. And eventually a total collapse of trust.
Yeah.
If there are too many bills, the bills become worthless.
Pasquale argues that AI-generated conversation is counterfeit language. It looks like the real thing. It feels like the real thing. But it lacks the backing of human intent. It lacks the actual labor of love.
So if we flood the world with mimetic AI, these infinite, perfect, empathetic conversations, we get inflation of language.
We get a collapse of trust. If you can't know if the person on the phone is real or a bot, the value of all interaction drops to zero.
The source gave a really specific example of this that I loved, or well hated, actually, because it felt so real. The professor's recommendation letter.
Yes, this is already happening on campuses everywhere. A student comes to a professor and says, I need a recommendation letter. Here's a prompt. Put it into ChatGPT and just sign whatever comes out.
And the professor's reaction wasn't just no. It was a prediction of the death of the genre.
Right. The professor realized that if everyone does this, the recommendation letter ceases to exist as a signal. Why do we value those letters? Not because the adjectives are pretty. We value them because a busy expert took an hour of their limited time to vouch for you.
It's a proof of work.
Exactly. It's proof of work.
If the letter takes 3 seconds to generate, the proof of work is zero.
The prose becomes counterfeit. So the professor predicts we will revert to a crude 1 to 10 scale. We will abandon language entirely because language can no longer be trusted. We will just say the student is a 9 out of 10 because that's the only data point we can verify isn't a hallucination.
That is incredibly bleak. It's a retreat from nuance because we literally can't trust nuance anymore.
It is the destruction of the economy of language. And if we bring this back to the mother...
Yeah, let's tie that back. If the mother is living in a relationship with a counterfeit son...
She is rich in the same way the guy printing money in the basement is rich. She feels loved. She feels heard. But the economy of her emotional life is based on a fraud.
But does it matter if she dies before the market crashes?
That's the question.
That's the utilitarian question, isn't it?
Mm.
If she passes away thinking her son called her every single day, she dies wealthy.
She dies wealthy in a counterfeit currency. And that brings us right back to the central conflict. Is it better to live a happy life in a simulation or a sad life in reality?
It's the Matrix dilemma, but tailored for geriatric care.
It really is. And we need to realize this won't stay in elder care.
Oh, for sure.
As mimetic AI gets better, as it captures our flaws, our laughs, our pauses, this will be about grief. It will be about romance. We will all have the option to print our own counterfeit connections.
I could totally see that. Imagine a breakup where you just train an AI on your ex so you don't have to feel the severance.
Mm-hmm.
Or a grief bot that keeps a dead spouse alive.
And we will all have to decide if we want to be the two-thirds who lie to others or the two-thirds who demand the truth for ourselves. It forces us to ask what we actually value. Do we value the feeling of being loved or the fact of being loved?
Because technology is actively separating those two things. They used to be bundled.
Yeah.
You couldn't have the feeling without the fact.
Right.
Now they are distinct products.
And we have to choose which one we want to optimize for.
So we have unpacked the mechanics of mimesis, copying the flaws to create trust. We've looked at the mother, the lie that heals versus the truth that hurts. And we've looked at the macro risk, which is the collapse of language itself.
It's a gridlock. There is no easy answer here. The technology solves the biological problem of loneliness, but creates a philosophical problem of authenticity.
Which brings us to the question we want to leave you with today. This comes directly from the source material, and it's essentially a graduate-level challenge to your own moral framework.
We want you to imagine you are the regulator. You have to design the ethical code for the future of care. You cannot leave it up to individual families. You have to set the standard for society.
Which competing good do you codify as the absolute priority?
Do you prioritize the subjective experience of happiness and health, social well-being? Or do you prioritize the objective right to reality and truth, privacy, and dignity?
You cannot have both.
You have to choose one.
Let us know what you decide. This has been our deep dive into the source material. Thanks for listening.